The following is an unrehearsed interview with Margaret Walsh by Mary Andrews for the Kentucky Oral History Program and the Friends of DeVue Park. The interview was conducted at Mrs. Walsh's residence in Park Hills, Kentucky, near the entrance to DeVue Park, on July 25th, around 3 o'clock p.m. Mrs. Walsh, I understand that you and your husband, John R. Walsh, were influential in getting the concerts at DeVue started. Would you give us some background to that and tell us how the program evolved?
I'd say it was more than influential. John and I were dating, and it was sometime in the, I think, early spring of 1936. And he lived in Covington, and we spent most of our time over here. And I lived in Cincinnati. And we'd take the streetcar across the bridge, and then we'd stop at Thompson's, which at that time was all over the country, like Child's was. And we'd have a couple of cups of coffee, and we're talking, and on this particular night, and I have no recollection of when it was, but a friend of mine that I'd known for a long time, who was a cellist for the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, came through, and he saw me, and he stopped at the table, and I introduced him, and I asked him what he was doing, and this was in the Depression, and he said that the symphony was giving concerts at various parks throughout the city of Cincinnati, and I believe that now they have also included DeVue Park, perhaps not for the same reason, but when he left, John asked me about this concert business, and I told him that they were just, people didn't have any money, they couldn't go anywhere, and the symphony would play at these various parks throughout the city so that people could enjoy the music. And we talked about it a little bit. And sometime later, he told me that he was thinking about it, and John and I both, of course, were practically broke, but he was always interested in helping the people who didn't have anything, and he was thinking about Goble Park in the west end of Covington, that he would like to give them a concert or something on the same order. So he started talking to different people, and I don't remember now, but he got, I think, a few merchants to donate the wood and so forth to build a wooden platform as a bandstand. And Bob Seidel, who is now, I think, our city manager, I saw that the other night, was the business agent for the Musicians Union in Cincinnati. And John talked to him, and they donated their time to get have a concert at Goble Park, which is being worked on now. They're building a carillon or something. And he talked to a couple of other merchants, or to the Green Line, I guess, who furnished a bus to go over to Cincinnati to get the musicians and bring them to the park and take them back to Cincinnati. And we were surprised at the huge crowd at this first concert in this little park. And I think we had one practically every week, and I don't remember. I don't think there were more than 6 or 7, something like that. I'm not certain. Then the next year when we started, it was so full that after one concert, John decided to move it to DeWoo Park. And he wasn't thinking about rules and regulations. I don't think either of us ever did think about that. And then I think it was Vince Keller, who was superintendent of the park, told him that he'd have to get permission to have a concert at the DeWoo Park, where there was this beautiful natural bowl. And so they built the stage just floorboards as a small stage. And then we had, as the concert went on, we had tents on each side behind the stage as dressing rooms when we the different people could, members of the orchestra and so forth, could use. And then in 1938, and I don't remember who told us about her, but we got a hold of Ruth Best, who still has an agency in Cincinnati. And we went over and talked to her and got her as a mistress of ceremonies. We also bought formed a corporation. And when I say we, I'm talking about my husband and myself. We were both very vitally interested in this. And we bought a Hammond organ. We had, I don't know what the material is, looked like thick cardboard, for each band member to have a music stand. And we put a big D, a big glittering silver D on the front of each one for DeWoo. And at that time, all of the nightclubs in this area were in full swing. So John talked to the different people who owned them. He knew practically everybody in the three counties. And I guess since then I have too, most of them. And he'd go to each one, for instance, he'd go to Jimmy Brink, who owned the Lookout House at that time, and talk to him about getting the star attraction to come to the park for scale, which was $15 a night. Because anyone who has ever done entertainment is interested in a live, big audience. And also, the first sponsor was the Kentucky Post. And as they were a newspaper, they got front page publicity before and after each concert. And Ruth Best also started a sing-along, where after the acts were finished and the orchestra went home, the organist would play different songs and everybody would join in and sing. And as the years went on, the crowds grew and grew. And in the 40s, we'd have I guess about 50 to 60,000 people. A lot of people would drive, but most of the people in the around the confines of the city would just walk. And of course, you always have to walk up. No matter where you are, you have to walk up a hill. And We counted 7 buses on one night from several different states, like West Virginia, Eastern Covington, and I mean Eastern Kentucky, and some of the smaller areas in Ohio and Indiana. They would just bring busloads to the concerts. There were no chairs for anybody except the musicians. Then John contacted the WPA, I guess it was, about a band shell. And I think this happened because Judge Bryson, who was one of the 2 circuit judges, was on vacation in California, and he sent a card showing the what is it called?
Band shell? The
amphitheater? So Judge Bryson sent this card to us showing a picture of the Rose Bowl and he's as an idea. And it was after that that John got in touch with the federal government about building such a bowl, such a shell. At the bottom of this amphitheater in the Blue Park. And it is quite large. Except they didn't make the stage wide enough and we had to have them redo it so that there would be more room for acts in front of the orchestra. And we had dressing rooms in there on each side. And we had all the top acts from the Lookout House, and the Beverly Hills, and Peach Mints in Newport, and the other one that's on I don't recall the name anyway, so I don't know what they're doing now, but they had a club, and each Monday we would go to one of those clubs and talk to the principal performer. And I can't remember all of the names, very few of them in fact. But I do remember that one time Sophie Tucker was at the Lookout House and John went up and talked to Jimmy Brink. And Sophie told Jimmy Brink she wouldn't sing outdoors for the Pope. But anyway, he persuaded her that he would send a limousine to bring her to the park. And they would come down the back way, just down the hill. And there was Ben Keyes, who had the concession stand, built a small concession stand up on top of the hill where people could get soft drinks and ice cream and things like that. And on the night she was coming down, when we got word that she was at the top of the hill, Bruce Browning, who taught accordion and was a very fine accordionist, and who had worked Keith Circuit with Sophie Tucker, was on the program. And he played her song, Some of These Days, as she came down the hill. And the crowd just roared. And she was thrilled to death. and I don't remember how many songs she sang. But the next year she came again. And from Beverly Hills, we got Jimmy Durante. And he was so thrilled with all the crowd. And Ruth used to ask all the little kids to come down to the front so she could watch them. And he just went up and talked to all of those little kids in the front row. And Ray Boland was there. And Mildred, and I don't remember her last name, but she was called the Rocking Chair Lady, who sang the song. And and whoever it was, who the last time I heard of him was in Miami. He had a club down there on the water. But he had starred in, I think, Pal Joey or something. And when he was there, we had one of the very few rainouts. It just poured raining. And he said no WAP was going to beat was going to beat him. And he came back the following week. And I think it was at that time that we had the Army make a picture count of the crowd. And I have a copy of it. And it's 51% of 55,000 people. And I think one of the chief reasons for the success of the show was that John would not have amateurs at any time. It all had to be professional, just so. And it was. Well, John was about 20 years older than I. And he was a disabled veteran of the First World War. And he had emphysema. He was gassed in France. And emphysema cannot be cured in any way. And it just keeps getting worse. The older you get, the worse it gets. Just eats up the lungs. And as the 40s and the 50s went on, it was harder for him to use the energy necessary to keep on with organizing these shows, and he tried to stop, tried to resign, and they wouldn't let him. So he stayed on for a few more years until I think about around 55 or something like that. And then he had to resign, and of course everybody knew that he was sick and there wasn't anything they could do about it. And then the show started going downhill. And also in 52, after the Kefauver probe into gambling, the clubs were shut down, and we couldn't get the really good talent that we wanted to have. And I don't even remember the last time they had one. And it's a shame. But as a part of the sing-along, Ruth would send me these songs that she wanted to use on a particular night, and I would type them on the slides, and we had a projector on a large screen, and everybody could read what they didn't know. In all of the songs of the 40s and 50s, and some of the old songs from way back, were always popular, and everybody sang. And Haven Gillespie was a very good friend of ours, and he was so pleased with it that he wrote a song for DeBoo Park, and I don't even have a copy of it. It seems to me it was something like My Kentucky Hills or something like that. But it was a beautiful song, and we ended every show with that. Anything else?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the Kefauver hearings.
Well, Kefauver was in the Senate, and he wanted to run for president, and he wanted his name to become a household word, so to speak, and it never has been. But he started this anti-gambling business with the syndicate, and he'd have hearings all over the country, and my husband was manager of the Kentucky Club, which was one of the best restaurants in downtown Covington. And he and the bookkeeper were subpoenaed to Cleveland. They were up there for a week. And John was ordered by the attorney for the club to talk to everybody, which he did. And he was just dismissed at the end of the week because the only place in Kenton County that the syndicate had anything to do with was the Lookout House, and I think the 514 Club down on Madison Avenue. There was a lot of syndicate work in Campbell County, but not in Kenton County. So they just, he and the bookkeeper, and with this big suitcase full of records, just came back. Because I worked with him at the club too, and I do work at home for the club, and there was no syndicate at all. But there are always people who are against something, against anything. And it's a little sickening to me that people just have to be against something. I had too much doing with my own life to worry about what other people do. I personally don't gamble, but nobody's going to tell me what I can do with the money I make. If I want to gamble, I will, as long as I don't hurt anybody.
So that you do think that the Kefauver hearings had a lot to do with the talent that you brought to DeBoo Park?
That's right, because there wasn't any place for them to be.
Where did they draw the talent after Kefauver hearings?
I think mostly from people around Cincinnati, from WLW and places like that. Singers and dancers and that sort of thing.
Margaret, in talking about DeVue Park, you mentioned that you and your husband formed a corporation. Would you elaborate on this, please?
I wouldn't say that I had any part in forming it, except that I've always been interested in anything that my husband did, as he was interested in anything that I did, because I've always been a businesswoman. I hate housekeeping and any part of it. And I always felt it was better if I do something that I enjoyed and paid somebody to do what I just bored me to death. So that I knew what was going on all the time. But anyway, the corporation consisted of 8 sponsors. I'm not sure that I can remember all of them, but the Kentucky Post was one of them. The Union Light Heat and Power Company was one of them. I think the Green Line was one of them, which is no longer in existence as such. Marx Brothers Furniture Company was one of them. One of the banks in Cincinnati, I mean in Covington, was one of them. And then a few years later, another bank took over in place of that. And that's 5, and I can't remember the others. And unfortunately, I don't have any records because John got rid of a lot of them, and after he died, I got rid of a lot of them, because I didn't think anybody would ever be interested in any of that. I used to have copies of almost everything, but I don't anymore. But we didn't have the trouble at that time in DeVue Park that they've been having here for quite a few years, with all of the rowdyism of youngsters and older people too, I guess, who, you know, I sit across from the entrance to DeVue Park, and once or twice when I first lived here, I'd sit out on the steps. And I could sit only so long because that there's just a constant stream of traffic in and out of the park. People going up, coming back, and going up. I'd see some of them 3 to 4 times a night. And they've had the residents in the park who live on the streets skirting the actual park itself. Had complained because of the rowdyism, and there was littering and everything else, and the police had been after that. And but at that time we didn't have any of that. There was always a park policeman from the police department who was stationed there to take care of the park. And on the nights of the concerts, of course, we'd have extra police from downtown because of the traffic problems.
This is side 2 of the interview with Margaret Walsh. Margaret, you were talking about the security in the park during the concerts.
Yes.
Is there anything more you have to say about that?
I think only that after the concert started to decline because of the lack of really good acts, we'll say, from the clubs, which were no longer in existence, that I think there was some interest, but after John got out of it, Carl Saunders, who was the editor of the Kentucky Post, and who was the treasurer of the organization for the part, for the concerts or sing-alongs, he drew on on amateur groups like high school bands and who are the girls, cheerleaders and people like that, and which John would never have. And I think that and the devoutism that started in the 50s was what caused the decline of the park.
Okay. What part did the city commissioners play in all of this?
Well, of course, the Boo Park was given to the city by Mr. DeBoo, who owned it, for the people in the area. And, well, I guess the city commission was one of the sponsors, too, if I remember now. And they were all brought down on the last night of the season and introduced to everyone. And John wouldn't allow a lot of chit-chat talk, that sort of thing. I mean, just a few words and that sort of thing was all that he was interested in. And I think both of us we're very much alike in that we don't want a lot of idleness in anything that we attempted. Mm-hmm. He has done so much for the city, and I would be willing to wager that most of the people, and he knew practically everybody, except a few of the older people who are still alive, even remember him. He didn't want to be on the stage, except if there was something going on that he wanted to direct, like to get the piano out, if we had a pianist, so it wouldn't be all ruined by the rain and that sort of thing. But he was not a part of the stage, except to be sure that it worked right. And I think Cliff Lash, who recently retired from WLW, was one of the orchestra leaders we had. And a lot of, I knew quite a few of the musicians because I've always been interested in music. And at one time I knew about half of the members of the symphony, Cincinnati Symphony. Mm. And I guess I took on some of his organizational abilities because the only club I ever belonged to was the National Secretaries Association International, and I was always very active in that for until 1965. And at one time, well, John was he was confined for almost 10 years before he died to the house, and in the latter few years to the bedroom where we did our entertaining and everything else, and we had our meals there. But at one time, toward
I guess it was about the middle of the 50s, I was asked to, if I would run for president of the of our branch here, of National Secretaries Association, and I couldn't because I didn't know how long my husband would live. I knew he was going to die, and I couldn't take on the responsibility of traveling, which you have to do. But I was always an officer of some kind. And I know one time on Secretary's Day, they asked me to speak with Gil Kingsbury, who was at WLW. And when I talked to him, he asked me to write the script for our interview, which I did. And then I sent him a copy, and then he asked the questions, and I answered it. And all of the girls were thrilled to death. They said I sounded very, very professional, and I was very proud.
That's good. I wonder if you could share with us some of the highlights of your relationship with your husband John, some of the things that you did together. It sounds like you were...
Honey, from the time that we met, we did everything together. He was interested in what I was doing, and I was always interested in almost a part of what he was doing. And he was not working when I met him, but he did get a pension from the government because he was disabled. And then Judge Goodenough, who is the father of the present Judge Daniel Goodenough, Judge Joseph E. Goodenough, visited our home for a couple of weeks while his wife was away. And for the Kentucky Federation of Labor, I had reported their state convention 3 different times. And that was something I didn't know I could do, but I did it because I was asked to do it. But there were over 500 delegates in from every walk of life, and half of them he couldn't understand, and they didn't always follow the rules, like to say what organization they were with and their names and so forth. But Ed Weiler, who died last year, he was the secretary treasurer of the Federation in Kentucky, and he was next to me, and he would always tell me what I missed or what they didn't say so that I could put it in the record. And I was always very proud because after I transcribed my notes, I'd send them to him, and he'd just send the notes to the printer without even proofreading. And I have the copies of all 3 of those. Well, when Judge was there, he liked to read, and he saw these, and he read them. And I think it was 47, his secretary had been having trouble, and she was leaving. And he asked me if I would take on the job as his secretary and court reporter. Well, that was one of the few times that I wasn't working, and I really didn't want to go back to work. But he insisted that I would be good at it. So John and I talked about it, and he said, well, why don't you try it? And if you don't like it, just call me, and I'll come get your things, and we'll go home. So, and I can remember when he took me down the first day. My typewriter was there, and he carried it upstairs. And the last thing he told me was, if anything doesn't suit you, just call me and that'll be it. And I was petrified. I had been in the courthouse, of course, many times, but not in the court. I have never been the type who was who's interested in trials. I don't read about them. I'm not a celebrity seeker. I'm not interested in who people are. I'm interested in people as they are when they're with me. And I think John and I were both very much the same way. And fortunately, through my experience with the Kentucky Federation of Labor, I had no trouble. And I worked for 10 years with Judge Goodman until he died, or until I think it was, he died in 58. And in 61, unfortunately, since 1950, I've had Meniere syndrome, which is affects the equilibrium to the inner ear. And I think after John, I went back to work immediately until after his death in May of 1960, until August, and then I took the month of August, and I just went over the whole apartment. I even did the rafters in the basement. I cleaned everything. And then a few, I guess around November or so, I started having attacks of Meniere syndrome. And when it hits me, I can't sit up, I can't stand up. I have to go to bed. And in January, I think it was the day before my birthday, I had the second attack in 2 days. And the judge called my doctor and he told him to get me over to Booth Hospital, which was right behind the, about a square behind the courthouse. And then he told me that I was not to go back to work for at least a month. And he told Judge that, but he told me that he wanted me to get away somewhere. He didn't want me to go home and brood. I think the reason it hit me was because I had been living on nerve alone for almost 10 years. I had this full-time court reporter's job. And then when I was home, I had to be with John. About the only time I went out was to an NSA meeting. And we had the very friendly neighbors next door, and they used to come over and stay with him until I got home. So that if he needed anything, they'd know what to do. And I think just, it was like cutting a string. All of a sudden I had no more responsibility and it outside of my job. And I think it just hit my weakest point, which was this ear. And as a result of it, I'm practically deaf in that ear. And so I was gone for, I think, 7 weeks. I went to France in Coral Gables, Florida, and just, I rested and I did a lot of shopping and bought a lot of clothes. And shortly after I got back, there was a difference between the judge and myself, and he wouldn't tell me what it was, except I knew there was something wrong. I even called my doctor and asked if I could see him, and he wanted to know. And he examined me, and he said, "I don't know what the judge has in mind, but there's nothing wrong with you." But nevertheless, I was fired, and nobody ever heard of that before. I should have had this job as long as I was able to do it. And he told me that I was sick. And I said, "I'm not sick. I was sick, and I'm getting better." Mm-hmm. And it had me very, very upset for a long time. But then I went with Judge Wehrman and his son. He was a county judge at that time. I went to their office, and I worked there 4 years. And I worked very hard.
You mentioned a little bit about your husband managing the Kentucky Club, and
yes,
you helped him with that. That is of interest to those of us who live in Covington. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there were four men who owned the Kentucky Club, and they were all friends of John's, although John was the oldest. But they made him complete manager of the restaurant, the bar, and the casino, in the kitchen. And he set up a system, a card system for the people who came in to gamble. And I would do the typing on those cards. I've been in the casino, I guess, twice, or three times at the most. One time when they had redone it, just to see it. But it was in order to have a record that if somebody wanted to gamble for more than they had, he would say no. And, but the dining room, which was always operated at a loss because they didn't charge high prices, but they had excellent food. And most of the doctors from downtown, besides people from Cincinnati, always ate there. And I used to, we had streetcars then, and I used to take the streetcar from the courthouse up to 6th and Greenup, and just walk down the block to, and I'd have lunch with him every day.
So where was the Kentucky Club located?
It was located across from where the Buick Company used to be. I can't even remember the name of it. It was between Pike and 7th on Scott, on the west side. It was originally a brewery, I think, years and years ago. And they had excellent food. And
is it still operating today?
No. No, it was torn down. And it's part of the Coppin parking lot. And there is a Kentucky Club that Frank Burns, who was one of the original owners, opened at 2nd and Scott. But there was no gambling. It was just a restaurant. And Frank and his wife were very close friends of mine and of John's. And I used to have dinner there, and most of the time lunch. And a lot of people from the courthouse would be there. I'd see most of the lawyers. I knew every lawyer around. And I was never pretty, and that's why I think I was good at the things that I tried to do. Because we all want to be loved for something. And I couldn't be loved for my looks, so I had to be loved for what I could do. And I worked very hard to be the best, and I did have the reputation of being the best court reporter in this area. And I guess I could still be it if I wanted to move to Cincinnati, which I don't like the idea of. I don't want to leave Kentucky, I love it. I get mad at it, but, or at the people, let's say, because they just don't think, you know. They believe what they want to hear, whether it has any truth in it or not. And that's what upsets me. They don't think about, they don't look into the future at all. And I think what they're trying to do in downtown Covington is wrong. I don't think it's going to work at all.
And would you like to explain where you're coming from there?
Well, I had a stroke in 1975, and I'm almost completely recovered about it, from it, except that, and I can drive. But I am afraid of falling, and I've always been afraid of that. And they have cobblestone sidewalks, which is horrible for anybody to walk on, let alone someone who's afraid to fall. And I remember that last Christmas Eve, a friend of mine took me to Midnight Mass at St. Aloysius. And after Mass, we drove to downtown Cincinnati, where the Fountain Square is beautiful. And then he said, "Well, come and look at Covington." And I never saw anything so pitiful and devastating in my life. There was nothing. There were two or three little scrawny trees with one string of lights on each of them, just ordinary Christmas tree lights. There was nothing. It was just as dead as it could be. And that's why I think I'm interested in being a part, if I can, of the Friends of DeVue, because I'd like to see something worthwhile done. I think a community scene would be wonderful, which could still be done. Even if you use just a tape recorder with a microphone for the music. It's just my idea, though.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you for sharing so much of yourself with us.
Thank you.
With City of Covington, with the Oral History Committee, and also with Friends of DeVue. This has really been a fine opportunity to get to know you, and I want to thank you on behalf of everyone else who will be listening to this tape and learning from it.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.